Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Main Monitor Radio Hour, a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Main Monitor. I'm Kate Koff, editor of the Main Monitor. This month, we're doing something a little bit different, and we are going to bring you the audio from a panel discussion we hosted in Portland on June 24th about the role ranked choice voting played in Maine's recent primary elections. You can watch the full panel event on video at themainmonitor.org. I hope you enjoy.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, both here in the room and on Zoom, and thank you to UNE for hosting us in this great space on this beautiful night. I'm Stephanie McFeeters. I'm one of the deputy editors at the Main Monitor. And for those of you who aren't familiar with us, we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan newsroom. We report throughout the state of Maine. You can find our news for free on our website at themainmonitor.org or in your local papers like the Portland Press Herald. We have a 2026 voter guide that we will be continuing to update as we approach November. And we also have a bunch of free newsletters. So if you're not signed up, you can sign up at the table at the front, or you can talk to me or our executive director, Mika, who's in the back if you have any questions. This event tonight is one of our monitor talks. It's something we like to do periodically where we get people together in a room to talk about our journalism so people can really dig into the reporting. And tonight we're going to be talking about Maine's recent primary. Maybe some of you heard we had an election recently. Some people paid attention to it. And we're in particular going to be focused on the role of ranked choice voting, which our elections and government reporter Matt Younker has really been focused on. So, and with that, I'm going to hand it over to Matt and our panelists to dive in.
Thank you, Stephanie. Hi, everyone. My name is Matt Younker, and as she said, I'm the elections and government reporter at the Maine Monitor. It's a relatively new role for me. I've only been doing it for about 2 months, but that's been 2 months that I've spent keeping a lot of close eye on the primary election, in which ranked choice voting has factored in heavily this year. After 8 years in use here in Maine, ranked choice voting has factored into this primary process like never before. Ranked choice strategy from campaigns and candidates rose to a new level, with both Democrats and Republicans making appeals to voters based on the ranking process. Maine saw more major primary races go to primary voting tabulation than ever before. And for the first time ever, we had two different statewide or congressional races featuring a come-from-behind winner, that winner who wasn't leading after the first round. In the 8 years prior, that had only happened one other time. So that's a lot to unpack in this primary election. And luckily, we have a group of panelists here who have some great insights on the ranked choice process. All three of them have different experiences and lenses through which they assess and interact with ranked choice voting. And I'm going to give them each a quick introduction here and then ask them to explain a little bit in their own words how they've been involved with the ranked choice process. So first we have Ron Schmidt, who is a professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine, where he's finishing his second term as department chair. He has published on political corruption, democracy, political power, and the media, and the Marvel Cinematic Universe, among other things. And his most recent book, Reading Politics with Machiavelli, was published with Oxford University Press. And he's currently working on a book about American exceptionalism in the 21st century. Next, we have Chrissy Hart, who is the executive director of Democracy Maine, which is a collaboration between the League of Women Voters of Maine and Maine Citizens for Clean Elections. She brings together decades of global advocacy experience and a deep belief that a healthy democracy depends on informed, engaged, and empowered people. And we also have Aaron Chadbourne, who was a policy advisor for former Governor Paul LePage, and who now owns a real estate brokerage in Gorham. He was named the 2026 Realtor of the Year by the Greater Portland Board of Realtors and serves as an occasional host on News Radio WGAN. I'm now going to turn it over to all three of them to explain their experience with ranked choice voting a little bit more in their own words. So, Dr. Schmidt, could you lead us off?
Sure. Thank you. And thanks to everyone for coming and for the invitation to participate. As I began academic training to be a professor in, as my students like to say, the previous century. And the Cold War was in its final throes. And democracy had a very specific meaning in that context. You know, democracy was what we did. And so I often wondered how many of my students, all of whom endorsed democracy, had a really clear idea of what that meant, really, or had many thoughts about it, other than that was our advantage over totalitarian states. And in the last 15 years, I feel like there's more of a sense of my students on campus about what democracy means to them, but less of a sense of a universal support for it. I would say the majority of my students want democracy, but feel like they don't have it, or that the form in which they have it doesn't really work. And then there are some students who wonder if democracy can even work in a political state like ours. And others who are very much worried about it and its function. And at some level, democracy functions like running off a cliff for Wile E. Coyote. It, as long as he doesn't look down, he doesn't fall. But when it occurs to him that he might fall, he does. And democracy works as a system of representation of the people for as long as the people think it works. If enough people decide that the system is non-functioning, it becomes progressively quickly weaker. And so I come to ranked choice voting really as part of a much larger and longer interest in democratic theory per se, and in how we think about democracy and how that works. And it struck me initially when it's first introduced into Maine as an exciting idea. It demands a lot of its citizens, but it also gives them strategies for empowerment. Ways to think about their place in larger coalitions within the parties, ways for them to think about how to strategize their voting, ways for them to have different kind of relationships with candidates. In this last election, I was saying to Matt before we started, I'm getting more questions from national media as they begin to wonder about the power of ranked choice voting to affect the majority in Congress in several months, and then more broadly about ranked choice voting as something that might come to other parts of the country. And there I'm less sure. Maine voters have a commitment to voting, which is awesome. And there's a very different kind of political culture here with an expectation that you know who's involved and you know the issues. And you expect to play a part in it. And although ranked choice voting demands more of the electorate, Maine voters are very much up for that, I think. I'm less confident about how that would work in a state like California, where I come from, or maybe a state like Illinois. But that's one of the things that we watch. And I guess with that, I'll pass it over.
Thanks, Professor Schmidt. Great to have your thoughts. Hi, everyone. Again, Chrissy Hart, Executive Director of Democracy Maine, which, as Matt said, is a collaboration between the League of Voters, the League of Women Voters of Maine, which has been around since the 1920s, a result of suffrage and that effort, a staid, nonpartisan political institution, if there ever was one, Maine Citizens for Clean Elections, which came to be in the mid-90s to advocate for our clean elections program, which is the first publicly funded clean elections program in the country, and Maine Students Vote, which really focuses on student civic leadership, education, and engagement. And like Matt, I am going to take the liberty of sharing that I am quite new in this role. I'm about 5 months into the job, and it was a big pivot for me. So I came from the world of global policy advocacy. I worked in DC advocating on foreign policy for more than a decade. I was at the UN for quite some time, kind of started my career as a Peace Corps volunteer post-college. But as I was sharing with these folks earlier, my first foray into politics was interning for Chuck Schumer in my home state of New York when I was 17 years old. He is still in Congress, obviously. He is Senate minority leader, and that says something. And so I was laid off in September of last year. I was part of sort of the DOGE, I don't even know what to call it, the consequences of that effort, having worked hand in glove with the State Department, USAID, the CDC, doing some really exciting work around the world. And so in the meantime, I had gotten involved with the League. And the League was familiar to me because my grandmother was a League president. So growing up, I saw that example. And she was part of a bipartisan household. And so I grew up kind of surrounded by really interesting political discourse. My mom was a union organizer. And so when I moved to Maine in 2020 with my husband, I was sort of shocked and delighted by what the political atmosphere is like here and how accessible it is. I think, you know, year over year, I just got more and more interested in engaging and, you know, joined up with the league. And then the opportunity to interview and take this role, you know, came around. And I thought, what more interesting thing to do than, you know, in this moment of political division, of what feels like a crisis of confidence in the systems of government that have done so much for so many in this country, to get engaged, right? And then to learn through that process how Maine has been a leader in the country in terms of structural reform, like RCV, again, our, you know, public finance, our public financing of campaigns, semi-open primaries, et cetera. We do things differently. And I think that's both a result of the feasibility of getting things done and fomenting change in this state, and also the fact that Mainers are people who are interested in independence and innovation and doing what works best for us as a state. I'll leave it there.
Oh, sorry. Great. I'm Aaron Chadbourne. As was mentioned, I am the 2026 Realtor of the Year, which is it's only been a week, so it's been like the third time I've been introduced that way, but I'm loving the branding. If I had known that that was going to go so well, I would have tried to be it sooner. So I come to this as a Maine voter, as a former policy staffer, and I guess as an occasional political commentator. And I do it from the right, but I want to say that the reason I was eager to be part of this panel, and I want to thank the Maine Monitor for putting it on, is because I think local journalism is so important. And I think especially at this time when everyone's choosing where they want to find facts, I think the more local sources of information can be, the more important. So I want to thank the Maine Monitor for doing this, and anything I can do to support local media, I will always do. I would say by way of background, since I'm a realtor now, so who cares what I think, I ran for election the first time in fourth grade because I was upset that when I would get to third lunch, they would be out of whatever it was that I wanted. And I gave a speech, and like this was a really like eye-opening experience, because I gave a speech about how we could have a color-coded ticket system and it would hold people accountable for what they said they wanted in the morning versus what they actually got in the cafeteria. And I saw the principal write it down, and they implemented it the next day. And that to me really said something about the power of elections, the power about running for office, and it was something that I really took seriously. The first campaigns I worked on was when I was in high school. I couldn't vote yet, but I volunteered for my local state senator, Bill O'Gara, former mayor of Westbrook and then state senator, who was a Democrat, while I was also volunteering for George W. Bush's election for president, who was the Republican. And I think that when I graduated from Gorham High School, I got a scholarship from the Gorham Town Democrats and the Gorham Town Republicans, which left everyone a bit confused. So I've always been interested in kind of the local aspect of politics. And although I was working for Governor LePage when ranked choice voting was passed by referendum, my first experience with ranked choice voting was actually as a freshman at Harvard when I ran for student government again, because that's a thing I learned to do in fourth grade. We were using a voting system that was ranked choice in its nature. It was the Hare-Clark proportional distribution voting system, which is a form of ranked choice voting when you have multiple people running for multiple seats. And it does reallocate votes, but in a very different way because of how it works. And so what I learned about ranked choice voting then is what I still believe, which is as long as you understand the rules of the game, it changes how you play the game. And it really informs the way that you approach it. So I'm a bit agnostic as what I think the best form of voting system is. I don't know that I prefer our version of ranked choice voting over other first past the post or plurality systems. But I think what's really important in any system is that people widely understand it. What I found interesting about my experience during the referendum cycle where ranked choice voting was passed is that I was focused on education and tax policy for Governor LePage. And there was question two, which was the 3% surcharge on incomes over $200,000 that I was focused on working on behalf of the administration. But what was interesting, I remember this, and I'll tell the story, and they probably don't appreciate that I do. I remember appealing to a campaign consultant for Bruce Poliquin at the time and his political team, saying, hey, this is something you all should be paying attention to. And they said at the time, well, we try to stay out of state issues. We stay focused on the federal issues. And I think that in hindsight, Bruce Poliquin's team might have wanted to pay attention to what was going on with how we changed the rules of how we vote. And I think that's the real thing in ranked choice voting for me, and particularly for people on the right side of the political spectrum in Maine, is I think that until this election, Republicans have largely been able to ignore ranked choice voting and kind of opt out. And that's kind of the approach they've taken. They don't like it. They didn't vote for it. They don't prefer it. The majority chose it. And so until now, I think they've largely ignored it in some ways. I think this election, we can talk about the ways in which the Republicans tried to pretend that they actually did want to think about it. But I find it interesting because I do think that fundamentally, whatever form of voting system we choose and how we choose to self-govern, the most important aspect is that it's well understood. People understand their rights, their options, and how to actually participate.
Awesome. Thank you all. I want to first circle back to something you said, Ron, about all the calls you get from outside of Maine. So I think that's a good launching off point to talk about, you know, how did we get here as a state and how unique is Maine's voting system compared to elsewhere?
I think my first response actually to connect with, did you win in fourth grade?
I did.
Excellent.
And then I got to be on the committee that chose the new playground, so it was a great payoff.
Maine's system is different from the way ranked choice voting has been carried out in most sort of larger systems. It's I completely agree with the idea that we need a dedication to communicating what the basic rules are of the game. And that's an area in which Maine, I think, has an advantage over other places where I've lived previously. The voting rules in California, at least when I left, were pretty opaque and had lots of staggered dates for participation in various things that weren't always made clear. And I think one of the advantages we have is that people are sort of used to the idea of reading through and doing homework on how the process works before they get too involved in it. So that has worked, I think, to our benefit. It is complicated. I mean, it's more complicated than a primary system, for example, but it's also logical, which I think is a big advantage for us. I look to the California system, for example. What California adopted in this last primaries is one in which there's just sort of a general competition, and whoever gets the most votes, the two top vote getters wind up competing with each other in the general. And in a state where Democrats outnumber Republicans, there was a moment where it looked like the two top vote getters were going to be Republican because there were so many Democrats competing against each other and splitting that vote up. And it's unclear to me, everyone I talked to who was the most engaged in that and the most talked about it were journalists or political scientists. Voters in California themselves didn't seem to be particularly engaged in it. And so I feel like the advantage that we have, at least on paper, is a cultural one as well as a structural one. I think our rules are more logical than other ranked choice voting rules I've seen, but I think the population is also more used to doing that kind of work.
And Chrissy, how important do you think it is that ranked choice voting started here in the state via two referendum questions versus legislation that initiated in Augusta?
Oh, I like this question, Matt. Yeah, I think it's incredibly important that we can point directly to the will of the voters, right? Ballot initiatives, citizen initiatives are how we do direct democracy in this country and in this state, and we have the privilege of doing this in Maine. Not every state allows citizens to bring a referendum to ballot to, you know, a citizen vote. So, yeah, I think it speaks volumes. I think it's an important indication that this is what a majority of people in the state want, which is exactly what we're trying to do with RCV, right? Is ensure that candidates who are elected to office are elected with a broad consensus, the broadest possible swath. And, you know, acknowledging what Aaron has said, yeah, I mean, I think there's a partisan divide, you know, among people who support it and don't support it, which I think belies the fact that it's really useful. I mean, that's what we saw in this primary election, is that RCV was incredibly useful in both the Republican and Democratic gubernatorial primaries, right? It made them competitive. It made them interesting. It made them collegial. And it resulted in two candidates who had a significant majority share of the voting, of the votes, right? And so, yeah, I think I think it speaks to Maine that this was something that came from Mainers and not from the legislature, although that was, of course, the genesis of the RCV conversation.
And also going back to 2016 and that initial question, Aaron, you mentioned your time in the LePage administration. I'm wondering if you can take us back to 2016 when you were working in the administration and we saw that first ranked choice voting referendum in Maine. Given the debate then and where we find ourselves now, Are you at all surprised with the current state of affairs for ranked choice voting in Maine, or is this sort of played out how you might have envisioned it a decade ago?
I think I would have thought that there were more races where it came into play sooner. And I guess maybe it's just a factor of who is on the ballot and which races you can use it and can't use it based on the Constitution. But I would have thought that we would have had more experience at this point, seeing some of the outcomes like we saw here, where like with Congressman Golden defeating former Congressman Poliquin, now you had Hannah Pingree beating Dr. Shaw, or Matt Dunlap beating Joe Baldacci. I think we would have seen more of those things play out that would give the citizenry time to think about whether that's what they wanted. I would have thought we would have seen, or, I mean, I was really surprised, and it's to Sean Moody's credit, but I thought 8 years ago that the Republican primary for governor would have had an interesting result. And it was an interesting one because I didn't think anyone was going to 50% on the first ballot. There was a weird overlap between Mary Mayhew and Sean Moody for who had the mantle of the next heir of LePage. So I was expecting to see it play out differently, but Sean Moody won with a majority on election night, and so it didn't come into play, so you didn't have the backlash. Same thing with Governor Mills defeating Adam Cody in that election. So she didn't win on the first ballot, but she had enough of a lead that ranked choice didn't change the outcome. So I think it's only when ranked choice changes the outcome from what would have happened had the plurality winner on the first ballot done it, that gives the Maine people the opportunity to reflect of, like, is this what we intended? And so I think I would have thought we'd had that experience sooner. I think it's playing out about the way. I think the challenge that I find with it for Republicans who have chosen not to participate, and I they have very principled reasons for doing it. Like, they just disagree. They don't want to vote that way, and so they don't. They just rank only the first choice, and they believe that whoever gets the most votes should win, and so they're not going to participate in it. Or they bullet the whole way because they are worried someone's going to try to rank their ballot and tamper with it, or they rank the whole way because they're a little bit confused about what happens in subsequent rounds. And it's that last category that always makes me uneasy, because there are a lot of people who are confused because they've never adopted it. So on the one hand, I'm respectful to the person who says, oh, I would prefer not to have that person win, but I'm not going to rank because I'm morally opposed to it. Okay, you're voting consistent with your conscience. You're taking away your option to express a preference later. I'm sympathetic and worried about the people. You know, I had an Owen McCarthy supporter approach me at an event that I was speaking at. And she said, I'd like to talk with you about the strategy of ranked choice voting. I've heard you say on the radio before, Republicans don't know how to strategize. And I think I had been talking about using third party candidates as a way to get more of your voters out. But she said, so I'm trying to figure out which round I should vote for my preferred candidate. I said, who do you want? She said, Owen McCarthy. I said, okay, well, here's what you should do. If he's your preferred candidate and you want him to win, I would recommend you rank him number one. And as long as he's viable, he'll keep your vote. She said, no, I think he needs it in like round two or three. Like, I think that's when he's going to need my vote. So I'm going to leave. And so she was trying to game out where to place her vote for him. And I don't think that that's an overwhelming view, but I think there are enough people that haven't had enough experience with it and that haven't had it explained to them in a way that they try to figure out how to optimize what it is they want to have happen in a system they don't understand. So I worry a little bit about that. I don't worry as much about the people that choose not to rank because it's a choice. Mm-hmm. And the way that I always explain it is, if you don't want to rank, that's fine. If you think your candidate is going to be one of the two left standing at the end, it doesn't matter whether you rank or not. But if there's someone that you think is likely to be one of the last two people standing and you prefer that it be not them, maybe you just rank your order in preference and you express it if you want. But if you don't want to have a say, that's fine too. You have just as much a right not to vote as you do to vote. And I think that's fine. That not voting can be a choice. And so, again, I tend to err on the side of, like, I really hope to empower people with as much knowledge about how the system works and what their options are for how they do or choose not to participate.
We need to take a quick break here. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU-FM. This month, we're bringing you a recent discussion from an event we hosted in Portland on June 24th, in which a group of panelists discussed the role ranked choice voting played in Maine's recent primary elections. Back to the show.
You mentioned how this was the first time we had two come from behind winners in an election. We'd only had one before. It was Golden over Poliquin. I'm wondering if it's that or other things that all stand out to you as sort of the one big takeaway from the influence of ranked choice voting in this year's primary. And Chrissy, we'll start with you.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it's really interesting that we had, you know, a sort of traditional what happens in, you know, 90-odd% of cases with RCV example in the Republican race with you know, the front runner becoming the eventual nominee, and then a come behind situation, which happens in about 10% of cases for the Democratic race. And I think that's really exciting because it shows the power of RCV and what it's intended to do, which is to consolidate votes for like candidates. And you saw, you know, three candidates on the Democratic side really lining that right up for voters and saying, like, we are a coalition. You know, if you vote for one of us, rank all of us and rank us, you know, close together. So I think, you know, that was exciting to see. I think that contrast is really illustrative for voters of, you know, the power of this. On top of that, I think having, you know, Hannah Pingree has had the most votes of any gubernatorial candidate ever, right? That says something about the sort of consensus goal of ranked choice voting and it being successfully achieved. So I think that was really exciting. Some of the things that I talked about, like I did a panel discussion with one of our national partners talking about RCV across some different states and municipalities. And I said, you know, as a relatively new Mainer who kind of came of political age in Maine with like the Gideon Collins matchup in 2000, right? And seeing, you know, I was canvassing door to door as a partisan, you know, at that point. I am now vehemently nonpartisan, just stating that for the record. But people who were exhausted by the political discourse, right? And we're going to see that again in this, you know, in this election cycle with the most expensive Senate campaign conducted ever again, right? And Mainers don't like this. Like, we know that Mainers don't like it. But I think the contrast is what we saw with discourse around the gubernatorial primaries, right? And like relative civility. You had, you know, candidates talking about their collaboration, their respect for one another, and, you know, and sort of putting down a roadmap before voters for how to vote in a way that you know, they viewed as strategic. And so I think that sort of calming of the discourse and forcing candidates to talk about the issues in a way that's nuanced, because some of them are really similar, right? So tell us what distinguishes you as a candidate and how that meets the moment that everyday average Mainers are experiencing. And so I felt that as a, you know, taking off my Democracy Maine hat, just as a voter consuming information. And I think that tenor felt really refreshing to me in a moment where nationally we feel so polarized, people are, you know, tense, they are consumed with a 24-hour news cycle, and we all need to just take a beat, take a breath. And so I hope that, you know, that trajectory continues, and I think it will as this becomes, you know, it takes time to adopt electoral reform, right? We're not going to see a watershed, you know, over a couple election cycles where people are all of a sudden RCV experts and they are, you know, dialed in on strategy. This is going to take more time. It's going to take more election cycles, but we see it, I think, having positive effect in the state of Maine by and large.
Ron, you want to give us your main takeaway?
Yeah, I'd like to. I spent a lot of time trying to convince students that our political parties are not ideological and philosophical movements, in part because they position themselves that way, but also in part because for my students, when they disagree with what you might call the establishment or the master narrative of the two major parties, then they feel like they have no voice in either party. And they feel less likely to then support a third party alternative than to just sort of shut it off. And I try to emphasize to what degree our parties really are big, complex, coalition-based organizations, and how there's lots of people who call themselves Democrats or Republicans who disagree with lots of other Democrats and Republicans, and how if you disagree with the head of your ticket, there's still a lot of room for you within the relationships inside these parties to articulate what you care about and to try to make that clear. And what I saw, particularly in the gubernatorial campaigns this time, is that message actually being made clear by party actors, which, and candidates, which I appreciate. Like I get how coalescing around a single message is really good for voter engagement and for turnout, especially in a general election. But I feel like it's really important to let voters know that you can disagree with the head of your party and still be a good member of that party because you're part of the discussion and you're not just shut down just because you don't happen to be what's on the bumper sticker. And I feel like particularly watching, these three coalition partners in the Democratic primary this time, strategizing the way they did, made that very, very clear. To a lot of people, the three of them looked practically identical, but I know to a lot of their supporters, they see huge gulfs, but not so huge that there isn't room for them to be heard.
So I viewed the three of them a little differently, because I do think, and I know each of the three of them pretty well, and I've worked with each of the three of them on various things, either with them or against them. But I think what I found interesting about their approach is it was less about building a coalition to support each other and more about building a coalition to keep the person that was in the lead from winning. And I saw the message they did, and I thought it was very clever, and it represents a maturity of thinking about ranked choice voting, was that the three of them joined together to deny the front runner from getting their second place votes. So it wasn't so much like vote for us because we like each other and we'd prefer each other, because I actually don't think they all would necessarily. I think it was all about one of these things is not like the other, don't rank him. And that's the message I took for it. I thought it was very smart, very strategic, very clever. I bet Shenna came up with it because she is very clever. And she, I think, has some of the like most mature and fascinating thinking about ranked choice voting. I had a Pingree supporter tell me a story of how she came up to them at an event and she referenced the donation they had made to Hannah Pingree. And they said, I forgot what it was. You've given $1,000 to Hannah Pingree. And since this is ranked choice and you can support more than one candidate, will you just give me your second place vote and half as much money as you gave to Hannah? And like, you have to respect that, right? And again, Shenna Bellows, leave it to her because she's done so much thinking about it. So I think there was a maturity there. And so I view what they did slightly different than trying to support each other and more trying to each for themselves game out how to deny the first, like the front runner, a clear path to use ranked choice voting. So it's interesting and that's clever. That's a new type of strategy that wouldn't exist without ranked choice voting. On the Republican side, I think there's still an immaturity of thinking about ranked choice voting. Some of these little weird coalitions that broke out at the end with Robert Wessels accidentally trying to tell people to ranked choice vote, because I don't know what it is that he thought he did, but he's, again, like a normal person, like that just was running because he believed he could change something. And he thought the way to do it was go and meet as many people as possible and talk about what he believed in and influence it. And he was quite successful as a grassroots candidate in influencing the conversation, being taken seriously. He's very well liked by all the Republicans in that debate. They saw him as earnest. And he basically said to each of them, I want to help you. And Jonathan Bush, I think, took advantage of that a little bit to say, oh, I'm going to use this to try to get your supporters to come to me second. And so that they kind of, and then that caused a reaction from David Jones out of, I think, somewhat desperation to try to get attention, to then try to form this alliance with Ben Midgley, who was like, okay, well, I love your supporters, so sure. But I don't think fundamentally that endorsements like that matter. I think there are very few endorsements that matter. I think people like Donald Trump or a Paula Page on the Republican side, like that carries some weight and will deliver some people. Probably Graham Platner's endorsement on the Democrat side carries some weight. But by and large, Mainers don't like to be told what to do or told who to vote for. And just because I supported you, like David Jones supporters, for instance, 44% of them went second choice to Bobby Charles, who David Jones said, my one mission is to make sure he doesn't get the nomination. And like 44% of his supporters went. I don't think they followed in that bucket. That's why I think the interesting strategic thing the Democrats did in clumping together to say, oh, we're fine with all of us, just not him, like I think was effective. I mean, the Republican side, I think we'll see over time some more sophistication and some maturity in how they think about it. I do think that there were two candidates, Ben Midgley and Jonathan Bush, who had either one not been in the race, it would have been interesting to see how this could have played out differently, because I do think the Midgley campaign had a ranked choice strategy the whole time, but I think they waited too long to do it. The last comment I'll make, and I know I was asked to comment on one thing and I've now done four, is that I don't know that the civility piece of it, I'm not sure that I buy, partially because a lot of the campaigns at the very end used like surrogates like Betsy Sweet or Ethan Strimling to go like attack Dr. Shaw. And when you see it coming out from outside of the campaign, but coordinated by the campaign, like there's something about that that just didn't feel good to me. And the other piece of it that I don't necessarily buy is I think there were parts of certain people's records that weren't examined that should have been. So like I host a Saturday radio show and I had all of them on my show several times. And there were things that like Troy Jackson, for instance, would say off air to me personally, and then I would try to get him to say on air about like some real questions we should be asking about Secretary Bellows' management of the Secretary of State's office, things that Matt Dunlap has commented on as well. And it's not like, you know, scandalous things like you'd necessarily read in the main wire, although some of those could have come up. But things like the fact that they printed the licenses that didn't scan, or that the license plates had to be sent back, and that happened on her watch. There was no discussion of her management of the Secretary of State's office as a qualification to manage all of state government. And part of that was because her competitors and her opponents didn't want to offend her supporters. But should we ask questions about the managerial deficiencies of the office she was running? I think we probably should have. So I think, number one, I don't necessarily buy that the civility only takes place. I think it becomes the dark arts move further outside. And I think that sometimes it leads us to not have conversations we ought to have.
Thanks. You did manage to answer like four or five questions in there that I was going to ask you. But I think the civility question sets us up well. I was hoping to get your take on this, Ron. In your estimation, because one of the big selling points of ranked choice voting proponents in 2016 and later was that it would reduce negativity in politics and it would help get money out of politics. Now, since then, I mean, lots of other things besides ranked choice voting have happened, but we've seen only more and more money pour into main campaigns. And I think it's hard to make an argument that our politics have gotten any more civil since 2016. Granted, there's a lot of other things going on, but in your estimation, as someone who studies people's involvement in politics, do you think that ranked choice voting has had a sort of moderating effect in terms of making things more civil?
Not really, but I think it's still an open question to me as whether it has the potential to do that in terms of civility. What Aaron says about the dark arts is, of course, totally correct, but you could argue that as long as the dark arts are seen as more of a peripheral matter rather than a central one, that's a good thing. There are going to be outside groups that present negative campaigning, and their degree of success or not, I think, can depend on circumstances. But the less that's sort of the basic meat and potatoes of campaigning, I think the better we are in terms of how the voters feel about the activity they're participating in. And money, I mean, frankly, since in 1977, the court said that political campaign contributions that go towards campaign speech are a protected form of political speech. And so that sort of campaign money is a form of speech, and therefore it can be regulated, but very carefully. And the court pays very, very close attention to how strictly that speech is regulated. And as long as that's a basic rule, there's only so much you can do to reduce the power of money in American elections. I mean, something like an election fund is a step forward in how you might change that, but it would have to be much broader and more sweeping. I mean, the idea of shifting from caucuses and sort of party top-down primaries to the sort of primaries we have now was to make them more little d democratically open and accountable so that the rank and file get a chance to give their two cents about candidates before the races are over. And that's great. That's a great aspiration. And it worked, but it also massively drove up the cost of running for office because the party can't really give you money until you win. And so if you want to run for the nomination to run for an office, the pollster money and the volunteer coordination money, and that's all you gotta find that stuff, and that increases the power of money, and that's just a factor of the larger system in which we do politics. So I don't want it to sound like I'm talking about hypocrisy, because I think it's important how much we centralize these things and what we see as most central to the process of democratic elections. Again, little d democratic elections, but I do think that to some degree, negative campaigning and large amounts of outside money in the process are going to be factors unless we make much more structural changes in the way that we elect people.
Chris, you mentioned the civility piece earlier. I'm just curious, you know, the League of Women Voters is a Maine-centric organization, part of a network of other states' League of Women Voters, right? Have you had any conversations with other leagues about whether politics in Maine are more civil right now than elsewhere?
Oh, that's a great question. With the caveat again that I am 6 months into the job, I have had some really, I've had some neat opportunities recently to network with some league colleagues and also just organizers from other parts of the country. Talking to folks from like Pennsylvania, Michigan, you know, states with significantly, you know, many times more counties, larger populations. I do think we kind of just do civility better in Maine by virtue of the Maine culture. And I think some of our structural reforms, you know, help that. But I do think it's kind of just the nature of Maine. And I would attribute part of that, too, to the fact that this is a really independent-minded state, right? We have nearly a third of voters who are unenrolled, 28.8%, I think. And that is a, you know, it's an increasing trend in Maine and across the country, right? People are abandoning like the two-party system and that affiliation in general. I think that's just a sign of the times. But yeah, I think overall, we do have a more civil discourse in Maine compared to a New York, a California, a Michigan, a Pennsylvania. I would say that's mitigated a little bit by the national attention some of our races garner, right? And the fact that we do see all of this outside money coming into the state, right? We had $1 million invested by a billionaire from Wisconsin in a ballot initiative that does not reflect the will or interests of average Mainers, right? I don't think trans girls in sports is the first thing on Mainers' minds when they wake up in the morning. And so, yeah, I mean, as the league, we are focused on RCV. We want to see it expanded to state elections in the general election, but we're also focused on getting money out of politics, figuring out what's the end run around Citizens United, right? How do we shore up voting rights? How do we make sure that civic education is a part of, you know, public education? How do we ensure that every voter has access to the ballot on election day in the language of their choice, with, you know, assistive voting machines if they need them, et cetera. So we're thinking about kind of the larger landscape to piggyback on what Professor Schmidt was saying of what it takes to have a healthy, thriving democracy where people's voices, needs, concerns are front and center and candidates are forced to come to the table in dialogue around that and to really engage with voters and consider what matters to them when they're campaigning and governing.
My best friend still lives in Southern California, and she was making fun of my driving a while ago because it's become so tentative and polite. And I said, you know, if I swear to God, if I cut someone off in traffic, it's going to turn out that they're my neighbor. And she found that amusing, but I don't think she'll actually change the way she drives in LA on the basis of that observation. And I worry that a lot of this stuff does benefit from our culture here in Maine in a way that doesn't translate to other places.
But I think that's what we were talking about. We were talking about the 2 degrees of separation before we started this, yeah. I think that is unique here, and I think that is part of why civility has always been it. But again, I cited the example of the Democrats using surrogates to do their attacks. The Republicans did too, right? All of the negative, like, weird AI commercial attacks on each other were from like outside PACs that were clearly affiliated with a candidate or another, but they could like say they had clean hands about it. And I guess they probably within the letter of the law did. But so I do think though, if you look at, I mean, negative campaigning, I always find interesting because it's effective, but it has a dual effect, right? It's effective at knocking down the person you attack, but there's usually some sort of blowback effect. And I think of Portland's election of Kate Snyder as mayor as an example of it, right? Spencer Thibodeau attacked Ethan Strimling. It affected Strimling, it affected Thibodeau, and then Kate Snyder won. And I think maybe civility prevailed in that one as well. So I do think that we're always gonna see negative attacks because they work. But I do think that, you know, again, this makes people think about the role they wanna play. And then everyone examined, I mean, that was one of the things that a lot of Republicans said is they said, well, I think that all the other candidates dislike Bobby Charles so much because of how he conducted his campaign, because of some of the attacks. I don't think any of them will rank him. And he was able to run at the scoreboard enough that it didn't matter, that you couldn't really, especially with, what was it, like 36% didn't rank, or they didn't, or they were exhausted. I mean, by the end. So you have to like kind of, if you're going to go that way, you have to like play it out so that you have enough of a lead that ranked choice can't change the outcome. But anyway, just random thoughts.
We need to take a quick break here. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU-FM. This month, we're bringing you a recent discussion from an event we hosted in Portland on June 24th, in which a group of panelists discussed the role ranked choice voting played in Maine's recent primary elections. Back to the show.
So I think we're getting towards the point where we're going to turn it over to audience questions. I just have one more that I want to get through with all of you before we do that. And that's that we just witnessed a week and a half of a ranked choice voting tabulation process, featured some delays and some questions about communication. And I'm curious what you all think about the risks of having a system like this that can take additional time to deliver a result, and whether you're concerned about the weight involved. And I think Aaron will start with you on this one.
So I think for elections to have legitimacy, there needs to be confidence in the outcomes. That's why I really always prefer decisive victories where someone wins by a lot, because then it's hard to argue that it was illegitimate or it was rigged or any of that. And we're obviously in an age with so much skepticism of everything, skepticism of the institution from both sides of the spectrum. So I think the longer it takes to have an outcome and the more that this ranked choice process and explaining how it is you have to prepare and handle and scan and do the things with the ballots and upload the thumb drives and format the spreadsheet, like all of that is not helpful to building public confidence. There are reasons we do it, right? We do it so that they can't be hacked, so that it's never attached to the internet, so that whatever else. But like, I mean, it's 2026. For any of the main municipalities who locally administer their election that can't afford a scanner, the state should buy them one so that they're all scanned in day one and we have the files. Like, that's something that we could do tomorrow. Yeah, I get that some of them will always want a hand count and whatever else, but like, there are things that we need to do to expedite this. The fact that, you know, and I think part of it was driven by the fact that our Secretary of State was herself on the ballot and didn't, I think what she did and stepped away from her responsibility, she should have done much, much sooner to give her staff the time to prepare the communication apparatus that they would need to be able to build confidence. I think some of the well-intentioned missteps of saying, oh, we're going to have the result in an hour, and then actually maybe in a couple hours, or we'll give you the 2-hour warning soon. And like, it set a false expectation that it could be done sooner, which then leaves room for people to start with the theories, or, you know, they just need to find some more ballots, or where was the Biddeford thumb drive, and like, how was it? I mean, the more that we leave room open for that, and I think the best way to do it is to do it faster. I remember having worked on a congressional campaign back in 2020, I was nervous about the Gideon Collins election going to ranked choice, and it was close. It almost didn't, and then Susan got over the 50%, so it never happened, which, by the way, I think is one of the things that's helping Susan Collins right now, as everyone talks about it, as a 9-point victory, but it wouldn't have been had ranked choice come into play. But it didn't come into play, so it didn't matter. But so I was worried that that outcome was going to have to be decided by ranked choice, because if the nation watched how we did the process then, which we've gotten slightly better, but not a lot better at, it would have been messy. And there would have been a lot of room for people to think that there was funny business there. And so again, the more that we can streamline basic non-controversial process to expedite the counting and expedite what the results were, I think the better.
Chrissy, you were nodding along to a lot of that, so yeah, I'm going to turn it over to you next.
Thanks, Matt. Yeah, no, Aaron, I largely agree with what you've said, right? I think it's a communications issue, right? And I think about like work I've done with the federal government and how there are examples of like federal agencies communicating what they're doing really well so people see the value of it. But for instance, you know, the average American voter thinks that we spend an insane amount of money on our foreign aid when in fact, you know, it's a fraction of a percentage of our annual national budget, right? But that is not communicated well to the average American citizen and the American voter. And so when, you know, the Trump administration came for federal agencies and the DOGE exercise, USAID was the first to go, right? Because there was not a critical mass of Americans who supported that agency. I think similarly, and I will draw a parallel here, I think openness, transparency, regular updates, you know, all of that will instill voter confidence in a moment when there is a lot of dialogue, and I'm going to call a lot of it mis and disinformation because that's what it is, out in the ether about fraudulent voting, about, non-citizens voting, all of these things that we know aren't happening because actually voter fraud is vanishingly rare. And I think I do want to credit this Secretary of State and her office in that they have made a very, very significant effort to be transparent, perhaps overly so to some extent, right? And I think there are ways that they could sort of tweak their approach, right? Like daily updates. You know, we at the League, we were present for most of the RCV tabulation, and the public can show up and watch, right? Like, we are invited to participate. And in fact, for this primary season, and this is related, we deployed 130 election observers, nonpartisan election observers, trained to polling locations around the state. We covered nearly half the state just to watch, right? To make reports. We could filter problems directly to the Secretary of State's office because we do work very closely with that team. We also were working with a national organization that has a voter protection hotline, but just to, you know, identify issues. And what we do is we collate those and we share a report out. We do post-election reports as the Nonpartisan League. And we also, after every election, write up a memo with the things we have observed. And we suggest ways in which the process could be improved. And we're going to do that again. We're in the midst of doing that. And in fact, one of my colleagues who is instrumental to that process is sitting here, Deb. It requires public investment, to Aaron's point. We have 503 municipalities in the state of Maine, and a third of them still hand count their ballots, which is great. It's probably not the best practice. We could do this a lot quicker if that were not the case. But we have stringent chain of custody. So when ballots are being transmitted to Augusta, when jump drives are being transmitted to Augusta, that's done by law enforcement officials. And when you think about the timeline, the actual counting and the processing of ballots and data didn't happen. It didn't start until the Friday after the election, right? And this tabulation process actually took the same amount of time for more races than it's taken pretty much every other cycle. But that's not the issue, right? The issue is perception. And so I suspect that we are going to see improvements made to the process, transparency sort of adopted and approached in a different way. And we're certainly going to be one of the strong voices at the table advocating for that.
First of all, we have John Martin to thank for our stringent chain of custody regime that we have now. But I would say to this Secretary of State in particular's credit, like back in 2020 when I had observed quite a few process discrepancies in terms of how ballots were handled. And they figure it out kind of anew every time, which they, again, could standardize and do a little bit better. But she's been very open to feedback and was with me. And so I do want to give them credit. And I think we were also have benefited for a long time from the long service of Julie Flynn, the Deputy Secretary of State, who, when she retires, again, we're going to have to go through a process of building trust. But we've had a very strong kind of apolitical team there for a very long time. And I think that's part of the challenge, though, too, with Shenna herself being a political figure. Because when Dunlap was Secretary of State, yeah, he'd run for Congress, but no one saw him as political. Charlie Summers, same thing. Everyone liked him. Shenna was a little bit more divisive. So I think it's interesting in how we build trust in that institution.
Yeah. Ron, your thoughts on the delay and or the wait involved in this process before we turn it over to questions?
Sure. I mean, you guys have really covered what I think is really central. From the perspective of democratic theory, we need to be clear about what we expect from institutions. You know, if the post office turns a profit, that's awesome, but that's not what the post office is for. And so the speed with which I get my sandwich is of much greater importance to me in a pragmatic way than the speed at which I get the results of my elections. And that's because what I expect from my sandwich place is a good sandwich quickly made. And what I expect from the ballot is the ability to have an effective voice in public affairs and a sense of real commitment to that. And that means communication and transparency. And I feel like that is a commitment that we get from a majority of people in public life and from a majority of our fellow citizens here, which is good.
Hi, I'm Emily. I have a question about how we're going to endure the next 4 months of incessant negative advertising. And it just feels already like it's beating us all to a pulp. And, the only beneficiary are the television stations and the other media outlets that receive the money for it. But in the end, I'm curious to know what you all think the real impact of these negative ads are going to have on anybody, because it seems like most people are just tuning them out and have already made up their minds, and there's nothing that these negative ads are going to tell them. I mean, it's going to be a lot of money spent to probably not change a lot of minds, or maybe I'm wrong on that.
I mean, generally speaking, you're largely right about the way that these things go, that voters have a decision already. Classically, the thing you warn about when it comes to negative advertising is the threat of turning the voters off so completely that they don't want to vote. And that can work to your advantage if you have a plurality of supporters who are really engaged, because other people had reach a point of saturation long before your supporters do and decide they don't want to be involved in it. Ranked choice voting should cut against that, I think. But as we just heard, that's not going to affect all of the races. So I don't know. My kid is really, really into theater and musical theater. And so there's a lot of musical theater numbers on YouTube played in the house. And it's been months now where they weren't accompanied by attack ads on Bobby Charles. And I imagine that, nothing's going to change for months to come. And for the sake of hearing, part of Les Miserables one more time, she'll put up with that. But But I think that there is an exhaustion level. I mean, again, I know I keep talking about it, but where I come from in California, that's actually a strategy. You know, people will put an initiative on the ballot because they can afford to do that, and then saturate the airwaves with ads just to muddy the waters around a central issue, and just in the hopes of driving down participation. And that's an eventuality you have to worry about. When I first moved to Maine, I used to say I felt like a character in The Terminator, because I'd come here and say, you know, where I come from, the horrible future I come from, this is what politics looks like. We'll see.
I don't have much more to add to that, except that this is why one of our three constituent organizations is focused on clean elections and getting big dark money out of politics, right? Because it oversaturates us. It's largely negative. It doesn't contribute to the discourse in meaningful ways, right? We want town halls. We want league moderated town halls where candidates are sitting face to face and talking about the things that people are asking them about. And unfortunately, we're not there. And until something substantial changes with our Supreme Court and Citizens United, I think this is where we're going to be for a while.
I'll just take the first part of your question, is how are we going to endure, which I would say summer and fall are my favorite time in Maine to be outside. Yes. So put down your devices, get outside, especially if you've already decided. But I mean, there is a very small group of people that haven't decided. The fact that you're in this room right now means you're someone who pays attention and pays attention early. So we're going to like opt out of being that undecided group. There is a small thing and they'll be influenced, but I don't know how it's actually going to matter. Can I ask you a question, though, speaking of clean elections? What do you make of the fact that none of the candidates chose to use it this time? Because I think when Garrett Mason used it last time, I was surprised that he did, because he'd been an opponent of it. Terry Hayes, I could understand doing
it.
But no one in the cycle?
Yeah, I think it just needs to be improved so it's viable, right? Like, which means higher thresholds for candidates to be competitive. That's my hot take.
Okay. Any other questions from the audience? Any more Zoom questions, or are we all set?
Can we cold call the audience and ask them questions?
Well, is there anything else the three of you wanted to stress before we wrap up? We've covered a lot of ground here, so. All good?
I think so.
Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us here tonight. And Stephanie or Mika, do we have anything to wrap up with, or are we pretty much good?
Like, I would say if we can end where we started, though, I think the biggest takeaway, if you could have any takeaway from this, I'm sure we all said interesting and creative things, but it's really that the only way our system works is if people understand it. And so whether you agree with people politically or not, I think it's important, number one, to talk to people that you disagree with, which I try to model by coming to audiences that I think probably disagree with me. But also, I think it's important to help people understand how ranked choice voting actually works, how the ballot actually works, what ranking means, how those things are. I think the one thing that slightly undermines people's confidence in it is that whenever it gets explained, there's usually a lengthy explanation that's hard to follow. And then they see the ballot and it doesn't match what they were expecting to see. And then they see a process of counting that isn't easy to follow. And then there's a magical black box component at the end that spits out a result. And so the more that we can engage in dialogue where there's clear communication about how it actually works, that can get us out of a space of fear, get us into a space of understanding, and then we can actually debate and vote for who we want and that stuff. I think that's probably my biggest takeaway.
That's great. Thank you so much to the Maine Monitor for setting this up. And this was a lot of fun. Yeah.
And thank you, all three of you, for being part of this conversation. And thank you all for being here tonight.
And
everybody,
thank
have a great
you.
Evening.
And thank you to UNE for hosting us.
Yes.
I really want to thank you.
You've been listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. The Maine Monitor Radio Hour is broadcast on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can also listen on the WERU app, subscribe to the show as a podcast, or download archived shows at weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Kate Koff, and this is the community radio WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill. Thanks, everyone.